I have this fantasy in my head that every, you know, Sunday night you guys are rushing out to get to get the new song done.
Well, we are rushing out a lot, but we have a long backlog of material, so we are kind of having a slow motion panic attack because we haven't finished all the songs for the year, but we're not on the deadline of having to get the one done that is coming out that week. We're basically, you know, we have a backlog of probably of, I don't know, 20 songs or something now.
It's a much bigger game of like 3D chess than the Dial Song Project has become a much stranger thing than it sounds like on the surface. I mean, I think if we were, there would be an incredibly, it would be so sweet if it really was just staying up really late on a Sunday night, making sure that like we got a good song.
Doing the work right. Well, that was what the Homestar Runner guys used. They would work on deadline right up until the day when the, you know, every week their thing.
Yeah. And in a way, I think we should figure out a way to actually do that at some point.
But not quite in this format, because I think part of the thing, what's happening now is we actually do have enough material to finish out the year, but what we're really concerned about is improving the quality of the material that has yet to come out. So I think, you know, we want to get more songs in there that are of good, high quality, so the sort of non-top shelf material can be pushed gently aside. You know, so this is what we're doing now. Is
it's such a strange culture that we live in now, because also there is this kind of high fidelity in YouTube comment section reality to anything. Like, I thought when we started this, the way it would be taken in, it would just be like, oh, this is cool, you know. But of course, now all the comments are just like, I like last week's song better, you know, and it's all just about comparing the material to itself and trying to figure out where to place the material. Like, all the interest and activity is kind of about how to quantify it or qualify it, you know, like, and it's not really about just taking in the material.
Yeah, I suppose it's we're in the position of those shows, TV shows we're talking about, where they have an episode every week, but they're obviously, their lead time is many months.
It's a little bit, I mean, I assume it's a little bit different in this case. It's the lead time is a little less prolonged than if you guys have to put out an album of 18 songs.
Yeah,
right?
we could fiddle around with it, but we have a buffer partly for our own peace of mind. We have a bunch of songs, you know. We never put it right up to the line just because we'd have a heart attack, I think.
Oh, and also we have to deliver stuff to iTunes like 6 weeks in advance. Like they can't just put it up. I mean, we don't have the Beyonce bat phone.
Right, so we have to be at least 6 songs ahead. But,
yeah,
you know,
and 6 songs is that's a month and a half is a pretty long lead time to kind of figure out what you want to do. Yeah. But, you know, the other day I did put out a bunch of index cards with song titles, with the songs that are in the works on it, and, you know, put like a little stars by the really good ones.
You want to there's plenty of time in the year now to make the end of the year really go out with a bang, you know.
It's so sad, you know, to feel like, I feel like, you know, our approval is like so provisional, you know, it just, it's everything's still a test, you know. It's like,
right.
Well, you failed the audition, boys.
I was thinking about this earlier too. I was thinking about, you know, just in terms of, you know, what I put out in the world, and I assume this is the case with you guys. Like, if you're not constantly getting something in front of people's faces at all times, they don't know that you're doing a thing.
Specifically,
like, you could put out in the world, you could promote as much as possible, but if it's not in front of that person's face, like, they might not even know you're a band anymore.
Oh, we can even work, you know, continuously for the past 30 years. and there's still a surprising number of people who are like, so where have you guys been all this time? Like, what, you know?
Like, when this, done since Don't Let's Stop.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, we've literally heard that from people that they're like, oh, it must be sweet, you know, being on vacation all these years, you know. I mean, you know, we're there are two things we do. We stay home and write and record, and then we go out on the road.
And they're both part of the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You don't strike me as people who need, you know, deadlines or parameters, just from the standpoint of, again, like, you guys have been working very, very steadily.
Well, a fixed deadline is actually a good thing, and that helps me quite a lot. Because I would just fool around. I work a lot slower if I don't have a deadline. So I know, you know, John is not too different from me in the way he works. But if we get a job, like if somebody says, you know, we want you to make a car ad for us, you know, just the generic, you know, kind of job thing like that is like, okay, that really focuses you. You know, it's not necessarily the closest thing to your heart, but you know exactly what it is you're supposed to do. You know, it's the terms are very set. That's the way it was with the Disney stuff.
Yeah, like those were actually, like, we were actually recording whole albums essentially on deadline because they would present, like, delivery dates that they needed it by, and they were totally not kidding.
Right.
So
whereas we're kidding.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting is that I think from the moment we got off of Elektra, a couple of things changed really for the better for us. I mean, and they're so knotted up together, it's hard to know, like, which thing was the most influential. But basically, we started taking on outside work, doing, like, work for hire for television, like we did incidental music for Malcolm the Middle, which was a huge weekly assignment, like, with crazy deadlines and literally just sort of pounding out music, you know, some very good, some incredibly ungood, but you know, it all sounded like music. And you know, at the same time, home computer digital music making technology just really jumped up from being kind of like making your demo with a drum machine to actually being able to almost capture, like, all the eccentricities of a demo recording and export it directly into a finished piece of recorded work, which was fantastic. You know, that really, I think, was a very exciting, it's really exciting to, when I think about how many years we just toiled in this sort of precious demo-itis world trying to figure out how to keep some fragile idea from getting destroyed by a fancy recording studio, and often kind of failing. And then, like, you know, the final thing is just, you know, just having not getting out of the thing of making an album every 2 years. There was this thing where we were just, it does kind of freeze you up to think, like, this is the only important official music we're going to be making for two, you know, with our name on it for 2 years, which was the kind of write, record, tour cycle of the major label deal. So all those things kind of happened around 2000. And since then, it's just been this very kind of loosey-goosey world. So thank you, Napster.
does it feel to some degree like less important, or, you know, less, I guess, less like historical? You know, there's a difference between, again, taking this long process, putting an album together, and then this just being your album forever, versus, again, you know, we're putting out 52 things this year. Right. They might just kind of sort of exist on the internet for a little while.
Well, I think, I mean, as you maybe can infer, we're still completely uptight about the keeping the quality control together. Not that, I mean, nothing to say about whether we're successful. I think, like, you know, if I could somehow stand on the outside of this project, I might see it differently. But I feel like we are doing good work. And we're really, really concerned about doing good work. And you know, in the same way that we're saying, like, you're judged completely on the basis of your last thing you did, that we still take that idea very seriously. The weird thing was, actually, in some ways, when we started, I think we were probably more happy-go-lucky in certain ways, or we certainly were more rangy in the way that, in, you know, what was considered appropriate material for, you know, for the project. I think now we're kind of like, oh, no, it's got to be better than that.
Was there sort of the perception of I guess in those days you guys figuring out what a They Might Be Giant song was versus now, like, it's I mean, they all sound different, but it's clear.
I hate to think that we've narrowed.
Yeah.
But I think we do have a sense of that it has to be of a certain quality because we know people are listening. Maybe that's the main difference. You know, that we're very aware that there is still an audience. You know, and we want to keep them interested.
I was talking to somebody about this recently. Actually, the guy who hosts the Moth podcast was trying to find the name of the track where the two people call into dial a song. I mean, is that something? Do you feel like that could exist now on a They Might Be Giants record?
Oh, I see.
Where they're trying to figure out what the hell is going on in this thing they call.
I hope that we can find something else as good as that.
Yeah.
To put on a record that was a high watermark.
Yeah.
For us, but you know, and yeah, it certainly wouldn't be disqualified on the basis of too fucked up. You know, I mean, it's really a wonderful, wonderful recording.
I don't know, like there was a few years ago, we did a sound check where you ended up doing like an improvisational song that was like 8 minutes long called Somebody Took My Eyeball.
Oh yeah.
It was really sad that we actually never had the only versions of it that exist. There's not the actual original thing, which was really like, it was as weird as anything I've ever heard.
Right.
Does not exist in the world, which made me very sad. But there are some high watermarks of sort of, I mean, what do you call that kind of material? Exceptional, you know, asterisk material.
Right.
You know, you have to put an asterisk by it.
Right.
It was on steroids.
Well, I think that track, the track with the people calling in didn't have a name. It's just the number on the...
Untitled. Yeah, it was number 13.
It was track number 13.
Yeah, on the compilation thing. But, yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
It seems in a way like it's sort of almost taking a baby step toward the instant delivery that a lot of people are doing. You know, that you're still running it through the machine that you've developed.
Oh yeah, it is the philosophy of Dial-A-Song that has driven this.
Yeah,
I mean, in some ways, it's at the core of everything we've ever done. But now we're kind of explicitly saying like, this is who we are. This is the philosophy of the band is like. You know, what is suggested by the original Dial-A-Song where you call up a phone number and listen to a song, you know.
Yeah,
that implies.
Yeah, but what is the
what the hell was
the
that?
Two? there's the name, there's the sort of the, I guess, well, the regularity
is,
of
this
it.
This is what I think, this is what it suggests to me.
Yeah.
Number one, you have this direct relationship to the music. Like, it's something that's happening. Somebody's making this music and you're kind of tunneling into to get it, and it's not being, you know, Dial-A-Song didn't have any intermediary. Like it was just, you know, it was like the idea of like you chip through the cave wall and there's another cave and there's some weirdo in the other cave.
Yeah.
But it's also like it's not broadcast, it's not curated, it's not presented by. And I think, you know, one thing that was very different about doing something like that in the 80s was that the entire world was broadcast, curated by, and the gatekeepers were standing ever vigil. Now we live in a world where it's just like a thousand noisemakers coming at you. So it's a little bit, with all the chaos around, it's hard to feel like that's a refreshing idea because, you know, at this point, culture seems just like, you know, is a lot more like panhandling and a lot less like, culture.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, in a way, there's plenty of stuff like Dial-A-Song in the world. So, but I think, you know, we that doesn't make it any less interesting for us. I think, you know, we still feel like that's an attitude that you can have about your music is that it's just something to put out there and not to to sort of market in some, you know, I mean, the crazy thing is that we do market ourselves. We are absolutely in the world of commercial music production. And yet I think we are sort of, in some fundamental way, we kind of like the idea that this is just like, you know, some like bedroom tape recorder project that is still going, you know, that wasn't really intended for to get a record deal out of. Yeah.
This is something that I've been thinking about a lot as it pertains to podcasting for obvious reasons. But you know, I think a lot of people are doing really exciting things in that medium. But the one thing that is really, I don't want to say impossible, but that nobody's really really captured about radio that is what drew me to the medium in the first place was this. You know, I was a DJ for a while, and I had a late night show, and I used to drive around. And the example that I always use, because I was hooked for years, is the Art Bell show.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And just the idea of you know, just flipping through the AM dial, yeah. And then this thing, you don't know what it is, you have no context for it, you don't know if you're ever going to hear it again.
Right.
And that's yeah. That's something that maybe doesn't really
well,
exist
totally
on the internet.
What Art Bell was, and the great thing was, not only was Art Bell a UFO. But once you knew about him, his callers were even more like that. They were who the hell were they? They were just like, you know, somebody. I mean, occasionally, I guess he'd recognize somebody who'd called before. Yeah. Like, oh, hey, Eddie, you know. Yeah. But they all had these mutually exclusive conspiracy theories or sort of UFO yeah. theories that. And Art Bell's thing was he was sort of like the air traffic controller for all the UFOs.
Yeah, I went back. I had a. Are you guys familiar with Night Vale, the podcast?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. We talked about this on a recent episode, so I went back and listened to it, and he had a open line for time travelers specifically to call it.
Yeah, yeah. Very good.
Well, I want to circle back to Art Bell in just a second, but what you were saying about hearing Art Bell for the first time reminded me very much. I was of an experience I had. In the halcyon days of They Might Be Giants, I was driving Grant of the Jickets El Camino through the Lower East Side, which in the early 1980s, mid-1980s, probably doing a show at, like, I don't know why I was driving his car, but I was, like, picking up something for the show.
Right.
That we were doing with the Jickets, and which was a crazy band that we worked with a lot. We opened for them a bunch. And the song We Built the City came on the radio, and it was the first time I had ever heard
a
the
new song.
Yeah, it was a brand new song. Yeah. And I think it might have even included like a novelty open where it actually name-checked the radio station that was being played. It might have been like WNBC AM or something like that.
Right.
And it actually, because there's like an AM radio in this El Camino. And I remember I actually pulled over the car because I thought I would never hear the song again. And it just seemed like such a strange
right.
piece of music. It seemed really, really commercial in this sort of Christian rock kind of way.
Right, right.
That, but also just epically unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
And just sort of just, you know, it just so like, audacious as yeah. as a song.
You thought it was so bad that it would just fall off.
I just didn't know. I thought my head was imploding,
yeah.
and it just when you were saying that thing about Art yeah. Bell, it just reminded me of that experience completely because it was. And then of course, like it just became a ubiquitous song that everybody knows. And I guess now. I just a couple of years ago, I saw that there was like a list of the worst songs
oh, it's
of
considered
all time,
the worst of
and
song.
It and yeah, it, yeah, it yeah. shows up on that, yeah. which kind of makes sense.
Yeah, it's in this category of it can't be an obscure song, I guess, if it's the worst song.
Yeah, ever. It's got to be people got to know. There are plenty of bad songs that nobody knows,
right.
But it's funny to and then we'll get back to Art Bell in just a second.
I didn't intend to specifically talk about Art Bell. Just
I don't know. I want to make
a point. I was in
Spotlight.
I was in Maine Drag Guitar in Brooklyn like a couple of years ago, and I was looking to buy an amplifier, and they had this this Marshall head like a big amplifier, and it was actually a really good deal, and it was a kind of a very specific kind of amp that I wanted. I was very interested in getting. And then I realized it had like a, you know, kind of like road tags on it. And it had previously been owned by Marty Balin of the Jefferson
really?
Starship.
Yeah.
And my wife actually forbid me to
really?
Buy it.
Yeah.
Really? She was like, that's
a bad
yeah,
person.
That's
yeah.
not coming in our door.
Yeah. She was like, you don't want a Jefferson Starship. You don't want to make music. Like in the tradition, like what if that's communicable? You
But yeah, I mean, that was, I don't know if you wanted to add to the Art Bell thing, but that was sort of my roundabout way of just saying, I mean, it sounds like, because that's I think was one of the things that was exciting about Dial-A-Song in the first place.
I think we've had that experience over and over again.
The Art Bell of music.
Well, not, I don't mean just about us, but I mean, stuff that we like is often that thing where, and this is what I wanted to say about Dial-A-Song, is that we're not something that's being, we can be your private discovery, you know, like that. That's sort of the, I mean, I don't know whether that's being successfully put forward by Dial-A-Song, but that was also the idea of Dial-A-Song, that you explore, you know, Gloria, woman just randomly calling numbers to find out what the hell it is, stumble on this thing, and you get to have this exciting experience of being like, I might be the only person who even knows about this, you know, kind of experience.
Is that it's something again? Like, it's so hard to create now, especially. I mean, YouTube. You know, you literally you see every single person who's looked at it, and they're all making comments. So the idea that it's just sort of a one off. I mean, probably it doesn't really make sense from a fiscal standpoint. Anyway, from the point you guys are.
You know, in some ways, even when it says a billion views on YouTube, if you're just reading some of the comments, it sort of feels like it's not that many people who are commenting at any given time. So it also has a certain intimacy anyway, like just in that little crowd of people who are in that day's comments, you know. So, I mean, I think that functions in a similar way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of, it's probably a large part of the reason why you guys have had such a loyal fan base is this this idea that, you know, you get to a certain level, but you can still just belong to them, you know, versus, you know.
Yes, we are your band.
Well, that's a tricky bit of business in the culture, though. I mean, I when I think about being in college, I remember there was this whole controversy around XTC going mainstream, which was such a comical idea in retrospect. Just because XTC never came close to even succeeding
Did they have a radio hit?
Dear God, I think it
was. Oh, right.
But no, this was years before that. Before that. Yeah. But this is back when they were like truly just kind of moving out of sort of, you know, the opening slot for U2 into just maybe headlining their own shows. But it was this classic, you know, suspicion of the thing that's double cool kind of moving over. I mean, there's a part of rock culture that's actually kind of dead at this point because there just isn't even enough. It's hard to even differentiate. Everything's so marginalized, you know, it's there is no big time in music anymore. But so it's kind of like, it's like, you know, what is that expression? Two bald men fighting over a toupee or something like that.
Oh yeah, who said that?
I don't know. It was I just heard it. I'd never heard it before. Maybe it's something that people have been saying for decades.
No, I just heard that expression, and it was I'm forgetting. I want to remember what that was about.
It's like that. That's what music.
It's like that.
One of the things though that's been fascinating me about the internet recently. Again, I think Night Vale is a good example of this, wherein you cannot have heard of something. And the minute you discover it, you realize that there are millions of people. Like how deep these specific subcultures get, but how blocked off everything are. And I don't know, maybe you guys are a bit of a precursor to that.
Here's the other part of that, which is I think there are a lot of bands that I won't mention their name.
I'll whisper them into the microphone.
That have a sort of cult quality, but that is partly based on this sort of insider status. I feel like this kind of crystallized for me recently. Like, I was thinking about these particular bands, and I'm not going to talk about their name.
Are these like fancy, pretentious art school rocker kind of bands?
Oh, maybe, yeah. Could be that.
They don't need no publicist.
Like, exactly. And part of the idea is that you're either in or out. Like, you get it, or you're a square, you know. And I think that was another thing that we deliberately avoided. Like, we really didn't follow that particular course because part of it would have involved not ever cracking a smile, like having a total like straight faced, like this is a very important thing. And I don't think we certainly didn't feel that way about it ourselves. We felt like, you know, everything is, you know,
Are you speaking about a metaphorical smile or an actual, like holding a pose?
I would say really it's like 80% metaphorical in that expression.
You guys really went in the exact opposite direction when you know, I mean, I, like many people my age, remember you from the Tiny Toons show. And, you know, you do, I mean, when you start doing albums for kids, that's running in the complete opposite direction of that, right? That's really saying to people, like, this is literally for anybody who can listen to music.
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't why, but I think we were sort of thinking, A, that we couldn't really fake that, but B, I think maybe being cool, being like the band that's the reason why you should like us is because we're so damn cool, you know.
And if you're gonna fake anything, Matt, you should definitely fake being cool.
Well, you know, but then it would still be fake, you know. Yeah. And I mean, not that, you know. I mean, apparently, there's a great story about the Beatles meeting Elvis, where they suddenly realize, like, he's gonna realize that we're silly.
Yeah.
Like as soon as he sees us, he'll know, you know. So I think that there is a thing where nobody ultimately is everybody knows they're ultimately not cool. But I think there are bands that successfully put out this thing, and this is their part of their platform is like, you know, you know, that's what you're buying into. And I think we realized early on that we couldn't do that, and we didn't want to do that. We didn't like that, you know.
Getting back to this idea of exposure, and you had briefly mentioned before, I don't know if this was a specific example, but you had mentioned doing a car commercial, recording something for a car commercial.
Yep.
Was that, you know, punk rock roots or anything else? Was that something that at some point in your career that you wouldn't have done?
Yeah, we declined to do an ad for Crazy Eddie in the 80s before we even, I think we didn't even have a record out.
But you know, the thing is,
I want to get back to Crazy Eddie.
Yes. Well, I don't mean to interrupt. Finish your thought.
Well, this is a parenthetical thought that you're having about this idea of selling out. Right?
Well, the thing is, we have been doing this for so long that the kind of the idea that we walked into our careers with, like the preset about songs being placed in various ways, has shifted so much, not only in the culture, but I think for us. And there are a bunch of specific things that have happened, and I think we're just an active band in the world, and we get things get sort of thrust upon us, and we have to respond to it whether we want to or not, whether it makes us feel comfortable or not. And I think one thing I've noticed is that we are much more comfortable with the idea of creating something new for any project. You know, when the people call up and say, like, we want you to do a theme for like a cable TV show, and it's called, you know, Amazing Vacation Homes, and you're just like, oh, sure, that seems interesting, whatever. You know, it's just like another kind of small creative challenge, and that is not something that we like wrestle over or think about, and it's actually not even something that we necessarily like do for the money, because the money's not like usually that great. It's just like, I mean, even something like Malcolm in the Middle. Like Malcolm in the Middle was a demo. Like the actual song was just a demo for a pilot. You know, so that was not something that we're like going like, oh, this is going to be, you know, this will be a real career shifting.
Right, better do a good job.
Yeah, so it was just like, you know, it was just kind of a casual thing. But the idea that, you know, of making another thing is kind of interesting to us. And I think, you know, making a song that's going to be on TV seems kind of fun. Like that actually, I don't think we're so neurotic or like controlling that we feel like, oh, people will misunderstand the context. It's just like, no, it's just a way to do stuff. I think what's interesting is that having our songs, like songs that already exist, being placed inside other nested inside other bits of culture is actually something that causes us a lot more anxiety, because I feel like that's where we're actually kind of losing control of the spin of what's happening.
Right.
Like, you know, we don't want to be recontextualized. Like we like being part of making the context of the thing. Like even if that thing's a TV show that other people are putting together, it's like there's something kind of, you're still in the sort of this creative enterprise. Whereas having some like movie, some teenage movie just kind of grab your song and like, you know,
put right, it. You become the hood ornament, and then you're associated at, with that, basically.
Yeah, and that's, so it's like, actually, it's the appropriation part, which is probably a better industry to be in anyway. Like, right. We're so bad at this. Like, nobody's excited about making incidental music for television shows. But for some reason we've been, we're just drawn to the small time stuff.
It seems to get back to what we were talking about at the beginning, that this idea of, of needing parameters, needing to know what you're building in order to actually set out to build something, right, and not just sort of stare at a, blank sheet of paper or whatever. Is that part of what's driven in the past, or what got you guys into making an album for kids or making these sort of like themed sets of music?
I think that it changed over time, because in the very beginning we had way too little of a brand to already be repurposing it or recontextualizing it. It was like we were trying to identify ourselves early on. This is the reason I brought up the Crazy Eddie thing was, we were invited, a lot of people who are old enough might remember from New York, this particular guy who sold stereo equipment. And I guess the guy who was the announcer wasn't Crazy Eddie, but everyone had the impression that he was. He was screaming at the camera, and he had a super wide angle lens on him, and he was just talking.
He might have even said, "I'm Crazy Eddie" at some point in the
course. He referred to Crazy Eddie in the third person.
Okay, did he? Like, okay.
He's insane.
Yeah, yeah. So we were asked, so I don't know where this came from, but we were invited to do a theme for Crazy Eddie. And what's so weird is like nowadays that would be like, oh yeah, that would be kind of an interesting job.
Like Crazy Eddie seems a lot cooler now than it did at the time,
At the time it was like an impressive thing. Everybody had to sit through these commercials. They were on all the time.
Yeah.
And we were completely unknown. So I think as far as we were concerned, it was just like, oh, we're going to be just the irritating soundtrack to this guy.
It would be like being the soundtrack to like the Trivago. Is that what it's called? The guy with belt and the...
Yeah.
That's exactly. Such a weird commercial.
That would have been the ultimate though, again, like, like...
Trivago, call us. Right. We got ideas.
But that would be the ultimate, being this thing that just sort of, existed very briefly, that everybody who saw it in the 70s or 80s, knew that song that you created, and now it's just not around anymore.
We'd be boasting about it now. If we had done it, we'd be like, yeah, we did. Remember that? That was us.
Right. But, but at the time, also, the whole... when you think about... I guess it's really just the effect of that the Beatles had over the commercialization of music, or the kind of the crossing of music into popular things. Because that was really considered... I don't think it was until like the Red Hot Chili Peppers did like a Nike ad or something.
Yep.
There were some very serious walls kicked down in like the mid 80s, late 80s that, we were not just generationally, like we're stuck like in the, Black Sabbath era, just going like, I don't know, man, it seems kind of uncool. It's just like, we just couldn't get our heads around the idea of having our songs placed.
Right.
And ultimately, like these days, people just think of it as like, that's the way you find out about new stuff. Like that's there are bands, new bands that just, that's what they, that would be like the best day of their career.
And that would have been true in 1950 as well, but it just wasn't true in 1980. Like
but it's also just so strange.
It seems like the new... It seems like the new Dial Song project is sort of the closest to kind of stepping away from your brains for a little while in terms of like, or at least in terms of like these sort of preconceived notions that you've had.
Well, it's just a new kind of format. I don't think it's a drastic departure in terms of where we're coming from or what we're trying to get across. But it's a new and interesting way to work, and it might turn out, as John was saying, like we're getting these weekly reports back, and it might sort of feel like eventually, well, maybe this, there was something nice about putting out an album all at once, which is that people would be swamped with however many songs, and then they'd sort through them and kind of make sense out of it. But now it's almost like there's this forensic dissection going on, and it could be good or bad.
Yeah.
You know, we've had experiences in the past where we put out material before the album that it kind of blew up in our faces a little bit because people, as good as the songs were or as good as the album versions were, the fact that we'd put out previous versions sort of undermined the impact of it a little bit, you know. And this isn't that because these are the exact same recordings. But it's just, you know, it's every way you work is different, you know, and you don't know what it's like to be on the receiving end, you know. I don't know what it's like to be a fan of them. I mean, I would love to, I'd love to not be me and actually just listen to the songs. And
I like these songs so much. I wish I could just listen to them as a fan.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah. The thing I really adore about this whole Dial Song project for the 2015 is just the idea that every week there's more, you know, another thing to just kind of contemplate coming from from the band. It's like I feel like, you know, it is not important to me that like every song we do be better than the previous week's song, but it does excite me to see how animated people are and just like how delighted people are, because I feel like you know, as much as I love, you know, making albums, it is sort of a lost format at this point, and the way people like take things in and sort of just the way people live on their computers, it's like people live on their computers with social media, and that's the way they take in culture is through social media, and having something like this just puts us squarely in that place, and that's a fine place to be. I mean, it seems like it's appropriate to this crazy moment that we're in.
I assume too. You know, I assume that in some ways, certainly not in others, but in some ways, that being in a band is like any other job or like any relationship where, you know, you need to spice things up from time to time, right? I mean, especially
like being in a relationship that's a job.
We've all been,
you know,
there.
Prostitute.
It's the oldest profession.
Oldest profession.
Yeah. You know, I guess, you know, for us, and I know you guys have both done some other projects on the sides, but you guys are constantly coming back to this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always been the most amazing thing to me is, you know, and it seems like, I'm sure that somewhere in there you guys have taken it somewhat of a break at some point, but it just seems to have been this pretty. No, okay.
The school holidays are
yeah,
are,
okay.
Go off and travel.
Bank
travel
holidays and,
yeah.
Yeah.
Bank holidays.
Yeah,
so,
those are great.
Finish your question. What's yours? I mean, you're just saying like, how do we stand?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's certainly part of it. And there was like a mind melt. There was a mind melt moment here where you literally, you know, did a parenthetical to a thought that
oh,
he was
well,
having.
We've done interviews before.
Yeah.
So,
well, I know. That's what I'm saying. But you know, it's like for most people, the way to sort of get you know, get out of your head and to sort of breathe some air into it is just sort of like. And you know, just work with somebody else entirely on something else completely
right.
different.
Yeah. Well, we know we do. We pretty much mostly work together. I don't. You know. I mean, we write songs individually, but it's all for this project. We, you know, we'd had a period in the late '90s where we did some solo. We each did some solo projects.
Yeah.
But this has been, you know, this is. John and I are going to be associated with one another, like after we're dead, I'm sure. That's just what it is. You know, I think we're lucky, you know, we figured out a really good, sort of method of working together, and it's very easy, you know, it's a very easy relationship.
Yeah. I mean, that's a thing that I keep coming back to, and you know, you don't, as somebody who writes, you don't have that opportunity as much, but you need somewhere in your life, you need collaborators, you need partners, whether it's like, again, like a relationship or a band or some sort of project you're working on, like it's almost impossible to do anything totally on your own.
Well, I think, like, you know, the music culture doesn't give a lot of, doesn't dwell a lot on, you know, creating a supportive environment or like, you know, that, right. that, you know, it's an interesting thing because obviously, you know, it was really good that Ringo Starr was in the Beatles.
You might say music culture does more than other, like there's a great man theory in almost every department, except for music, where you have this paradigm of the band, which only really started with the Beatles.
It goes both ways, because like I think the thing is, there's so much hero worship of individuals in rock music, but anybody who's in a band knows that cooperation's a really big thing. Mm-hmm. And then the sort of layered on top of it is the final weird, like, gang power of like something like the Beatles, which is like, but that's just like a four-headed god kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
You know,
two and a half or three great men, right? You know, I mean, that's what people. No, but I mean, in a sense, it's a band, but people still single that out. People still want to look at the Kinks and, you know, try to figure out if Ray Davies was a genius in that band. You know, it's like,
But I think Flan said this, like, every band has. Ray Davis, he's brilliant. I don't know how to say his name. I thought you were good.
That's an English thing. Yeah, that's a weird.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I thought you were actually were dissing him in a subtle and interesting way. Yeah, Ray Davis, he's a genius. No, I was going to say, like, and I think John originated this thought, is that every band has a Mike Love, which is like the guy who apparently doesn't get to be called a genius, but when you look at the band and the work, you realize like there couldn't have been a Beach Boys without Mike Love.
Well, somebody actually wrote this book about director star partnerships, like collaborations, which is like an interesting thing. I mean, like one thing about, you know, our collaboration is that we are often just functioning as the editor, or sort of like the first, not even editor, it's like too big a word, because it's much more gingerly approached than like an editor actually has, like, you know, sort of can tell the person what to do. Like, but there is like this sort of first audience thing about what we're doing. And then there's also like this, I mean, there's so many different dynamics in being, you know, when you're in a duo, it's always just this crazy contrasting thing, like whatever, you know, we might be exactly like on 90% of the stuff, but whatever that 10% difference is going to be the thing that defines us as being different. Like, I think that the truth of it is there's a ton of aesthetic things that we completely are unified with one another on, and that is why it works. Like, it's very easy for us to sort of roll down the road and it's not just because we're so damn cooperative, because I don't think either of us are particularly actually cooperative at all. I think we're actually both really like super willful people with really big ideas about.
Well, I think also, you know, like even if you're on your own, I think you find things to disagree with yourself about, you know what I mean? Like there's always that, you're like, yes, no, kind of feeling about
the voices in your head.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, that's the other side of it too, is you need somebody to tell you that you need to stop beating yourself up over that thing, you know, or to sort of push you to maybe put that thing out into the world. You know, I mean, that's in a lot of ways we're our own editors in that, you know, we
start beating yourself up, I think, is also underappreciated.
There's start beating yourself up. There's start beating yourself up, which I think plays into plans what you were talking about a little bit of, like, you know, of actually being somebody's editor, but also I think there's just sort of like idea of like, oh yeah, I had this dumb thing, I don't think it's worth anything.
You're right.
Somebody else sort of. Oh, well, that's why we can't be in a band together.
I mean, ultimately, I think the strange thing about They Might Be Giants as just a project in general is that, you know, we have found that, in a way, having all these small outlets for what we're doing is just a real invitation to do interesting work, and it's like, you know, sure, maybe if the stakes are really high, like, you'll come up with something, you know. I mean, I feel like, you know, Birdhouse as a sonic thing benefited from all the weird Saturn V magic that like a major label deal could like pour into a song. Like, we actually, there was a really good, I actually heard the demo of Birdhouse in Your Soul mm-hmm. yesterday for the first time in many, many
Which
years.
Which one?
It's the Dial-A-Song demo that's got a completely different set of verse words.
Oh, wow.
And it was actually, I think, I'm pretty sure it was the thing that was presented to
Clive and Allen.
Well, there were two. Simply put, it's not the super short one.
Right. There was one where, because this is my memory, it's like there was the original demo, which I think they'd heard, and then I put together this thing, which is like, oh shit, we got to make a nice, like,
It's
super
official,
shiny one, and I flipped the drum beat around, so instead of going, you know, snare kick, it went kick snare kick snare, and these guys listened to it and they were like, you wrecked it,
yeah,
you ruined it, and it was really interesting because I thought I was making it sound more like, you know, official, you know, like,
right. Anyway, it's it's infinitely less tricky than the super short one.
Right.
In a lot of different ways.
I
think ultimately, like, working with those guys was actually a great learning.
Well, that was really good because they were like, you really want to take what's interesting about what you're doing and focus on that.
Amplify it.
Exactly, yeah.
It's a rare thing with a major label, at least in those days, it seems like.
Well, we can wail on major labels all day long, but, like, you know, it's...
Or producers.
But for them to actually just say...
Let's talk about some other producers. they were very creative producers and everything, and I think, you know, the fact that they had a ton of hit records is sort of testament to their thing. I mean, they were really into eccentric sounds. Like, I think their whole notion was that, like, a song has got to make, like, a really bold original statement. And that's, like, never a mistake. When you meet the producers, like, it's really good when it sounds like something else. You know, that's like the sort of stinking thing.
Which you can hear on the radio all the time.
Yeah. You know, they get somewhere, but they don't really get everywhere. But anyway, I mean, like, I think, you know, it was great to have that experience. And to a lot of people, maybe, like, just, you know, knocking it out of the park like that is, like, the only thing that matters. You know, I mean, there are a lot of people in the world who just want to be famous, you know. But if you want to make interesting work, sometimes it's kind of interesting to lower the bar. I guess that's the thing. It's like, you know, for us, I think we find that if we actually just have, like, a good excuse to make more stuff, it's just like, that's, you know, we're gonna do some good, you know, we'll figure out a way to do some good stuff.
I think lots and lots of artists have this experience where they do something that's like a side project that totally lights their fire, like you know, where they're like, I'm just goofing around, you know, and then suddenly it's like, I remember why I like music now. Like, it's like, you know, this is the part I like, not the big shiny part.
You said something, and I don't want to skip over this because I think this is pretty fundamental that this moment when you tried to make a pop song that appealed to the, you know, these big producers, that's when, like, you realize that your idea of what made a super popular song was the complete opposite. And I think, you know, I think there's something in that.
Our impulse was good, which was, we were like, we have no idea what people like.
Yeah.
You know, we're never going to figure it out. We're just going to do the thing we like. And if somebody likes that, then that's the best situation we could be in, rather than do something, second guess other people.
Sure.
But successful for some reason and then be stuck doing that. You know, what a nightmare.
The dynamic changes when you get fans, right? When people are expecting something out of you.
Asshole fans. Yeah. That would change the dynamic. No, I mean,
when there's an audience, though,
you want fans who like what you like. You want the fans to be you.
I'll just be contrarian. Like, who's got bad fans? I mean, nobody.
I can't say their names. But
I mean, there's not a band in the world that has, like, you know, there's no such thing as a bad. I mean, what's a bad fan?
Well, this is. I mean, I would just, without actually getting mean about other artists, I think there is this idea that we've talked about, which is people who are liked by everybody but loved by no one, you know, who just have
those are very peculiar bands. You mean like the Pointer Sisters, or
I mean the Pointer Sisters? No, I wasn't thinking of them. But
I'm just saying,
but,
like, you know, they had like a million hits on the radio, but like I don't think somebody anybody's who's like, oh my god, I've got to see, like, I love the Pointer or Heart.
Right.
I mean, things the 90s.
But often things that are sort of massively successful have that quality. I mean, they often do have a core following of obsessive people who really like them. But then I would say, you know, there's other things there's a thing you have a sense about, which is that there's stuff that is just kind of tolerated by everybody in a way, like,
unoffensive.
Unplug the microphones and say who you're thinking about.
At this point in the conversation, the members of They Might Be Giants discussed bands that are liked by everyone but loved by no one. The contents of this discussion are now forever lost to history.
Probably should wrap, but
I want to gossip more.
Yeah, well, we can do that, but we should finish the interview.
Since we're out of time, I want to suggest, like, you know, as you guys push towards the end of the Dial song, I think you guys should get as frantic as possible. I want to see some, like,
bust it out, like, turn it up to every day.
Yeah, well, every day. I want to get some, like, you know, like live in the studio. I want to see you guys write that final song in person.
Right.
New Year's Eve,
have a big, like, songwriting party.
Yeah. It'll be a live improvisation. Yeah. We make up the song on the spot.
Right.
All
you need is love.
We did. Remember, we did a recording years and years ago where we just made up a song while the tape was rolling. I'm surprised we haven't done more of that. That was actually really a fun.
Do you feel like just like after doing this for 30 years that you've done everything at this point that like I could mention some crazy idea?
Luckily, we're forgetful, so you know we can do it again.
No, there's much more to be done.